From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made across the country in conversations about anti-racism movements and education. The deaths of George Floyd, of Daniel Prude, and many other people of color at the hands of police have led to discussions about systemic racism and how to create change. Are those conversations inclusive? Specifically, when we talk anti-racism, are we including Native Americans, indigenous peoples? In an op-ed for The Hill, contributor Ryan Benally wrote, quote, "While some folks would question whether anyone would give the time of day to hear grievances from our small group, I challenge those skeptical. Our small population and our voices, not always heard, are the very reason as to why our voices should be heard just as loud," end quote. He argues that throughout America's history, racial inequality has hit tribal nations the hardest. So do indigenous communities feel included in anti-racist education? Do they feel included and equal in parts of society that are talking about making real change? And let's talk about the art world as well. Our guests are exploring who gets featured, who gets included, whose work gets featured and shared. And Ganon Dagan has a lot to share with you. I'm very excited to talk to our friend Peter Jemison, not only about the issues we're talking about, but about art, because our guests are going to tell us all about Ganon Dagan's juried virtual art show. Let's talk about it. Peter Jemison is the historic site manager of Ganon Dagan, but art is in your blood, I know, my friend, and I'm really glad to talk to you about this and a lot more. How are you, Peter?
I'm very well today. Thank you very much.
It's great having you, and let me also welcome our other guests who are with us on the line this hour. Jamie Jacobs is from the Tonawanda Seneca and Turtle Clan and a Best in Show winner. Jamie, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me today.
You got it. Leith Makua is from the Oneida of the Thames Wolf Clan and a first place winner in the beadwork category. Leith, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
And Natasha Smoke Santiago is from the Mohawk, from the Turtle Clan, and second place winner in the sculpture category. Natasha, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
We're going to be linking photos, pictures, links to their art that you can check out. It's out there now. We'll also link you to some of the work that their peers and colleagues have been doing and that Ganon Dagan is featuring. And there's a lot of really beautiful stuff here. And Peter, as we kind of move towards art as a discussion, let me kind of start a little bit more broadly. When we're talking about whose voices are included, whether it's art or whether it's really anything in this country, how much do you agree with what Ryan Benally wrote for The Hill when he said that too often indigenous voices are not included?
I would say he's right on. You know, most of the time, as you say, the loudest voices are not ours, and the voice, and they think of us as, you know, there's not that many of us, so what could we have to say? And, you know, we hear things like, oh, let it go, this all happened in the past, and you have to move on. But in reality, treaty obligations are still impacting us, loss of land is still impacting us. And, you know, as we saw during COVID, that there are populations that are really living in a marginal manner, and it's very difficult when something comes out of the blue and then begins to impact their community. It's a real scramble to provide adequate health care. How do they get water? How do they get electricity in some cases? These are issues that are real, and they come out when something like this pandemic occurs.
Well, and let me read a little bit more from what Benally wrote in The Hill. He wrote, quote, "Throughout our nation's history, racial inequality has hit tribal nations the hardest. From the inception of the United States, Native people have had to face unprovoked attacks from the American military again and again, endure the manifest destiny philosophy of American territorial expansion that removed us from our homelands, to the stealing of our children and taking them to government boarding schools in attempts to eliminate the essence of our cultural heritage. Of course, there's the ongoing racial disparities many tribal members face today in the forms of poverty, health disparities, and inadequate housing," end quote. Some of what he wrote was an effort to simply educate on history. And I'll read, Peter, an email from a listener named Michael who sends us the following, quote, America's original sin is the genocide and stealing the land of the Native Americans. Monroe County sits on Seneca land. Whoever talks about that? The first biological warfare was conducted against the Native Americans when they were deliberately given blankets infected with smallpox, end quote. How much of these issues do you think are even really taught at all? I mean, whether it's infection, sending children to boarding schools, trying to remove cultural aspects from indigenous peoples, how much do you think the average American who's not an indigenous, Peter, knows about that?
Again, I would say next to nothing. You know, what really we have to deal with, Evan, is what I call American mythology. I know I've talked to you before about this, that there's a kind of a mythology that has been created which really covers over all of the, you know, the warfare, the broken treaties, the taking of land, and, you know, as you said, the boarding schools and children being shipped off to those. None of that is included in the story that, you know, Christopher Columbus discovered America. We had we were invited over by the Pilgrims to enjoy Thanksgiving dinner. You know, this was an empty country. It was undeveloped. And there, you know, there was no one here on the land. And so people just kind of went out west and began to develop a land and a civilization, quote unquote, totally ignoring the fact that there were people here who had governments, who had, you know, a way of life, who had a knowledge of the environment that they're around, that was surrounding them, and who were managing and caring for it. All of that, that's part of the story, is really not taught. And so the other thing that is not taught is that we are the original artists of this country. And today you have, you know, three really great artists that are on the phone with us. And it is our art that speaks loudly to people regardless of their background. And it really, the quality of it speaks loudly to people. And so one way in which we are attempting to establish that we are a vital, you know, voice, that we are here, well alive and doing great things, is through the art. And that's why we've created this Haudenosaunee Juried Art Show.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking about the art. And frankly, in so many ways, you know, there are connections to what we've already discussed here, Peter. I mean, the idea that for a long time there was an effort to remove cultural aspects of indigenous people. Certainly art is at the core of the culture and the connection to history and values. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. One more thing I want to ask you before we dive into the artwork, Peter, is that in the weeks before the recent national election, President Trump talked about his desire to see the opposite of what you just described about education. When you talk about the importance of being more forthright about history and getting away from American mythology, the president believes, well, I don't know if he believes it, but he doesn't believe it's mythology. And he was touting in the weeks before the election the importance of returning to the subject of American greatness, American exceptionalism, and America's unique great character in the world. And there are a lot of people who sort of found a poll that is appealing to a lot of Americans, if we're being honest. That is appealing to a lot of his supporters, and he had 74 million votes. I guess I want to ask you, Peter, how you bridge the divide and the gap that says, you know, I understand that you want to believe that this is the greatest country in the world. You are certainly welcome to believe that, but it's important to grapple with an honest account of the actions of this country. How do you sort of bridge that?
Well, one way in which I would bridge it is this. There are Indian roots to American democracy. You know, people like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson were very aware of the form of government of the Haudenosaunee, of the Six Nations, and that this government was a representational government, and that the people selected their leaders, and that the leaders represented the people's views and interests. And this was something that did not exist in Europe. There was nothing like this form of democracy that we had here. Women had rights equivalent to men's rights, and all of that, you know, had a strong influence on American democracy and the form of government that was established, the republic that was established. But what is beginning to happen is, you know, this country is moving away from that kind of notion, is moving away from this, you know, form of government that really listens to the voices of the people. And this, you know, is a very dangerous move. I mean, it moves toward a, what I can only think of as a totalitarian type of government. And so I think people have to understand the roots of their government and understand their own history in order for them to see what is it that we should be proud of? What is it that we should glorify? You know, eventually it came around that they gave women the right to vote. Women did not have the right to vote in the way the government was originally established. And so when that occurred, that, you know, gave franchise to all of these women who previously did not have a voice, had no rights. So, you know, understanding how they were influenced by our women and how the government itself was influenced by our people, this is one thing that is, you know, this is a true history. Let's teach the true history. What actually happened and how did people come to, you know, exist in this country the way, you know, the way it was established? How did that come about?
Well, Peter, you've been presenting Indigenous artists for decades now, and I know there's a lot to talk about with Jamie, Leith, Natasha. When the art world leaves out the voices and the work of artists like Jamie, Leith, Natasha, and so many others, do you think it is based in racism, or do you think it's based out of sort of ignorance of frankly, what is out there and the quality of it, Peter?
I think it's a combination of the two. On the one hand, you know, they are really not acquainted with our cultural traditions, and so therefore they don't really know, you know, what the work, when they see the work, they don't know what the roots of that work are. You know, the fact that we used porcupine quills previous to using beadwork, and that we were using the natural materials that were in our environment to create our art. But we were creating abstract art long before there was cubism and long before there was abstract expressionism or minimalism or any of those isms. You know, there was actually a, you know, an abstract form of art here that women were creating in sashes. They were used to, they call them, for carrying a backpack, basically. And, you know, that those were beautiful, and they were really woven from women's imagination. And, you know, so what people like Jamie are doing is picking up and reestablishing an interest in this traditional form of art, but taking it to a new level and going beyond what they've seen in museum collections to create their own, using their own voice. And the same with the beadwork that's going on, and the same with the work that Natasha has done. You know, it's enlarging and going beyond the original tradition, but we have to be a living culture. We have to be one that's evolving and continuing to change.
Talking to Peter Jemison from Ganundagan, and where do you want people to find some of this work, some of which is for sale, right, Peter?
Absolutely. It's for sale. Haudenosaunee Art Show is online. You can go through the Friends of Ganundagan and find it there, and it will be online for almost another month now, and the work is for sale, and we've had really good sales. I'm really happy to say that, and we also have another show that is opening for the winter. We have the Juried Art Show that's up now, but we have another one that will be opening here later in December. And so let me throw this over to someone who might be ready to talk a little bit about their work. Jamie, can you jump in here for a minute?
Sure.
Yeah, so Jamie, I'm going to start with you on some of the work that you've been doing, and I've been looking at some of the examples here. Tell us a little bit about, well, let's just start with what your creations are and how you work. Go ahead.
Sure. So my creation is a handbag that's been artwork on both sides. It's made from hand-done leather, so it's not commercial. There's no chemicals in the process of tanning the leather. So it's all a natural native process of, you know, tanning the leather. So the things that I use are mostly from the natural environment. So Peter had mentioned earlier in the show that Native Americans, especially in the Northeast, have utilized animal byproducts. So the animal in particular that I use is the porcupine. So porcupine, they have these sharp quills on their back, as everybody knows. But what a lot of people don't know is that you can utilize those quills. So the way I harvest them is I don't go out and look for a live porcupine, because obviously they're not just going to give them to me. So what I usually do is I usually will find people who hunt or people who already pull the quills off, and then I purchase them from them. And then what I do is I dye them different colors. And once I dye them to the colors that I need or that I'm looking for, I can soak them in water. And when I soak them in water, what they do is they soften. And once they soften, I can flatten them. So I sew them down to the leather in different patterns. And after they dry, they kind of re-harden again. So the way a porcupine is, like, if you ever see one up close, it's almost like a hollow straw, but it has like this foam-like material in the center. So that's why it's able to flatten and collapse it. So what I do is it's kind of hard to describe over the radio, but what I do is I use needle and thread, and then I embroider them down to the leather, and I embroider them in such a way that I can form these patterns. And the patterns are indicative of our culture. The colors represent different colors in nature or colors that represent our way of life. So our primary colors are usually red. Red is a ancient color that goes back to all humanity and all human ancestry. It's found all over the world in cave paintings, red ochre, and mostly probably because it's the color of life. The blood that runs through our veins is red. White, obviously, is another primary color. It's like, you know, the main color. Black, it's another, you know, human color, because half the day is spent in darkness. And, you know, we have, you know, this dark color. Another color that I used and on the handbag was yellow and green. And I think those are the main ones. On the one side is a thunderbird, the thunder beings, or the thunder and lightning that travels over the sky in the summer months. We personify them in the form of this bird, a thunderbird. And when the lightning comes down from the clouds, it's, you know, represented by the lightning coming from the eyes of the thunderbird. And when we hear the thunder crack, it's usually because the bird is flapping its wings, and we hear that sound, and then it brings rain, and rain replenishes the earth. A lot of my work is I get inspiration from pieces that our ancestors made, and how I do that is I've been working in the museum field for probably around 15 years. So working in the museum field, I'm able to have access to pieces that were collected historically from the 18th century and the early 19th century. So what I do is I study these pieces to see how my ancestors created them with the materials that were available to them. I look and study at the patterns and the techniques that they use. And then what I do is I put together this conglomerate, and then I put in little bits of my own style and my own work to put together a piece of my own. So the piece that you see is a conglomeration of pieces that my ancestors made. So I didn't copy them 100%, but what I did was I took different pieces and different designs and put them all in together, and then I added my own little designs here and there to form this one piece that represents a time period that spans a little over 100 years. So all the techniques that you see in the bag that I created, that's where the inspiration manifested from. So it brings me a lot of joy, one, because of the historical aspect. You know, that's, you know, my job is just, I have a lot of fun what I do. Number two is I pay pay homage to my ancestors and the designs that they were able to create. And three, just for my own self and a legacy for my family, so that one day maybe they can look at a piece that I created, you know, 100 years later or 200 years later, and they can be proud of that. The tradition will carry on that far, and that's my hope, and that's my dream, is that someday my great-great-great-grandson or granddaughter will be able to look at my piece and say that, you know, their ancestor was contributed something to society that was beautiful and, you know, contributed to the culture and to humanity itself.
Jamie, as we talked about earlier in the program, the history in this country of trying to erase Native cultures, sending kids away to school, learning, sort of changing the educational programs, and stripping out so much of what you have tried to uphold in your artwork. Does that sort of intensify the importance, as you see it, of passing on these traditions and making sure they are protected, given what has happened in this country?
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, because, like I had mentioned earlier, a lot, 90% of my bag is made from natural materials, and three animals specifically, porcupine, caribou, and deer. As we all know, that not only is humanity, you know, going through this period of change and maybe a little bit of self-destruction, so is our environment with the idea of global warming. The caribou are becoming less because they're moving further north. Colonization is having devastating effects on the animals that surround us. So it's a multi-layered piece, because not only has the technique that I use, porcupine quill work, it disappeared for a while. And the reason it disappeared is because colonization had this large effect on my ancestors' ability to go and hunt on lands that they were no longer allowed to go and hunt on. The deer population had become so low that because of colonization and because of industrialization, that the deer just for a period of time wasn't available. Porcupines were, you know, not so plentiful. So their culture was being erased even then in the form of artwork because of colonization and because of all these things that were coming around them that just were unfamiliar. So they had to adapt, and that's where beadwork comes in. So the resurrection of this art form is another layer to my piece, is to bring back the older forms of art, not only to the world, but to my own people, and make them familiar again that this is something that our ancestors once did and that we should be doing it again. So I hope that answers a little bit of
the question. Yeah, it certainly does, talking to artist Jamie Jacobs and Peter Jemison. As we look at Jamie's double-sided Seneca handbag, or if we look at Leith's beadwork or Natasha's sculpture that we'll talk about, you know, artists need a market. And Peter Jemison, it's one thing to say, I want to learn about new cultures, I want to appreciate them. It's another for someone to say, you know, I'm gonna buy a piece of this art. I want to display it at home, or I want to, you know, have it prominently somewhere in my life. In a world in which people are worried about, well, am I appropriating this culture, or is this for me, you know, so to speak? How do you view that for the art buying public, Peter?
Well, what I think the best way we have of dealing with this is for them to meet the artists themselves, and in most cases, that's what we've been able to do through our festivals and through this art show that we put on annually, is for the artists to be present and for them to actually take the time to talk with the people that are interested in their work. And that approach really, you know, breaks down these barriers about am I allowed to do this? Am I allowed to, you know, have these in my home? And, you know, we also spend a good deal of time talking about what is it that is sacred to us and what is it that we really don't want people collecting as a piece of art because it's part of our sacred way of life. And so, you know, those are pieces of education that we have to do. But I've always felt that when the public meets the artist and the two of them have a conversation, they find out how much they have in common as opposed to how different they might think of themselves. And also, whatever our people have had as a background, you know, not everyone grew up in a reservation community. Not everyone had the advantage of being able to learn their language from a first language speaker. Everyone has come from a different situation. Whatever that is, it's an authentic situation. It's an authentic story. And when they share that with the public, again, I believe that brings them closer. And then they begin to develop that appreciation for this work that first caught them simply because of its aesthetic beauty. And now they see a deeper meaning to it because now they've met the person who actually produced it and they learn how and why that was produced.
Talking to Peter Jemison from Ganondagan. And again, we're going to link you if you want to check out the art. It is for sale. And you're meeting some of the artists here, but there's a lot more artists who we don't even have time to feature in this hour. We've got to take our only break, and we're going to come back and talk to Natasha and Leith about their work as well. Jamie Jacobs is with us, an artist, many artists whose work featured through Ganondagan here. So let's go ahead and take that only break and come right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we talk with Eric Adams, Brooklyn Borough President and candidate for New York City Mayor. Adams was a captain in the New York Police Department who's been an outspoken critic of police. He'll be a virtual guest of Rochester Lifestyle Medicine to talk about how adopting a plant-based diet helped him lose weight and lower his cholesterol. But first, he's joining us on Connections to talk about all of that and more on Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to bring in Natasha Smoke Santiago, who was born in Rochester. Natasha Smoke Santiago is from the Mohawk Turtle Clan and a winner in the sculpture category. We're going to talk about the work there and how she sees the work and, frankly, the people and her traditions embodied in the work. Natasha, thanks for being with us. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So I'm looking at some of the sculpture here. Tell me a little bit about growing up, and then as I'm reading here, in your early teens, you returned to, I think you returned to Akwesasne, but tell me a little bit about your path there.
Yes. So I was born in Rochester and raised there, and I spent a good deal of time also in Tonawanda, where Jamie's from, and that's actually my first experiences at Longhouse, so I still like to come down for midwinter. That's where my heart is at in terms of Longhouse. We have our own Longhouses up here in Akwesasne, but it's just home down there to go to Tonawanda. And moved home when I was 14 here to Akwesasne, so that was quite interesting to transition at. That's a hard time to you know, move and meet new people and be accepted, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, Akwesasne is way up north from what I think I'm seeing. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're about 5 hours up north, 4 to 5 hours up north from Rochester. It's 5 to Tonawanda, five hours.
Okay.
And our family's still really connected down there. I have two uncles that live in Tonawanda. And I love to come down to Ganondagan prior to COVID. Ganondagan is one of my most favorite places in the world. I've seen it grow tremendously throughout the years since I was a little girl. I learned so much there with the circle of people who I consider family. And, you know, my grandmother was a big part of it every year, my mom. And so, you know, growing up, I was behind the art table watching my grandmother sell her moccasins or my mom, her beadwork. And, you know, pretty soon I started creating my own artwork when I was about maybe like 8 years old. It was when I first started selling my work.
Wow.
I'd put little things on the table. And I focused mainly in painting for quite a while. And I think actually when I was about 18 years old, there was a festival at Ganondagan. And my mom and my stepfather were set up there. and I kind of took over their whole booth. And I kept borrowing things. And I realized that, you know, as a young lady, I needed to invest in my own table and booth and things like that if I was going to continue this artwork road pathway. So that's what I did. I invested in, you know, tables and chairs and easy up and started doing the little different, I guess, powwow trail or art shows and here and there all over New York State and sometimes up in Canada because we're right on the border here. The border comes through our territory up in Akwesasne. So I do quite a bit of traveling. And I started focusing quite a bit more with pottery and our traditional pottery and pipe making. After I moved up here, I took a class when I was 17, and I had no intention of becoming a full-time potter at all. It was just something that I wanted to learn about our culture, and needless to say, I fell in love with it, and I feel like I was pulled into it, and it was circumstantial how I became a potter, so to speak, and so that's become my main focus. I've been fortunate to have been able to study in many archives to study the old pieces, like much like what Jamie was saying. I've been studying and doing a lot of reproduction work to the point where I've become very comfortable with our designs, almost like memorizing them, but creating my own design at the same time. But, you know, being an artist, I don't stay just in one area all the time. I'll have a rotation going on sometimes, jewelry. I don't paint as much as I used to. It's mostly, you know, pottery or clay-based work. And then also the piece that I had placed in this art show was taken from a life casting of a woman's body. So basically I casted her belly in plaster strips, and then that cast was used as a mold to where I poured a pottery grade really strong plaster in. So once that comes out of the form, it looks exactly like the mother. Everything looks exactly like the mom. It's smooth, it's not lumpy like the cast. And then I use that as my canvas, so to speak, to paint on and to create. I've kind of gotten known as the belly lady for a while because I did so many of the castings. They were mostly women from Akwesasne, and I would do different Haudenosaunee elements. I did basket bellies, pottery bellies. The one that was in this show was a corn. I'm into seed keeping also, our traditional Haudenosaunee, you know, our heirloom seeds. So that's really important to me, is our seed keeping and our history, everything. It's art is such a good way to express yourself, to share, to teach, you know, to share with others. It's a great dialogue starter, and I think that's what we're all doing here.
Natasha, if I could ask, you know, when you think about the way your art either gains an audience or doesn't. I mean, I am curious to know if you've seen more openness to your culture, to your work and your fellow peers' work, because I think that ties into the question that we were talking about with Peter at the outset of the hour, which is, what do we truly mean by inclusion? And what do we mean by anti-racism? What do we mean by the work that aims to bring in more voices? And are we overly focused on maybe that idea to the exclusion of voices like Indigenous peoples? How do you see that?
Well, I guess I can only speak for myself, and I feel like I've always used artwork personally. Well, for myself, it makes me feel good. It makes me happy. It just feels so naturally a part of me. And then furthermore, trying to maybe capture different elements of our culture that I feel are so special or important, or maybe perhaps something that I didn't know about that I learned about, you know, meanings of, say, maybe like wampum or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to paint pictures to capture that story that I learned and to share it with others so that it can be preserved and utilized in the future, hopefully. Even though a lot of my artwork in the past was more, I guess, contemporary, more modern with, you know, paintings. And then now I've gotten more back into our traditional style of the pottery. And there aren't very many Haudenosaunee potters and pipe makers. There's a real small amount of us. I want to say less than 10 of us that I know of that are actually practicing potters and pipe makers. So it's really scarce, and I feel like it's really important, like Jamie said, to bring it back, to have our family and community become familiar with it again. And it much the same way that I would, you know, I would agree with Jamie that I would want my family to maybe look at it in the future,
mm-hmm.
100 years later or more. You know, maybe someone will carry it on in my family. That's my hopes right now, even with my own son. My son is 8 years old, and he's really, out of all three of my children, he's the one who's interested the most in the clay. And I would hope that, you know, he would want to carry it on.
Yeah, beautiful.
So my goal is to build a very soon my own studio where we can have room to work and have happy memories and create, and you know, eventually that gets passed down to them, that's theirs, and then it's theirs, that, you know, theirs to cherish or share whatever they want to do with it. I don't know if I really answered your question.
Sure, no, absolutely. I appreciate the sentiment. And the work is beautiful. You can see Natasha Smoke Santiago's work that we're linking on our various platforms, and that Ganondagan has brought in with their virtual juried Haudenosaunee art show. Let me bring in Leith Makua, who is from the Oneida of the Thames Wolf Clan, first mm-hmm. place winner in the beadwork category. Leith, thank you for making time for the program. Can you describe some of the work you're doing with beadwork?
Well, the work that I submitted for the virtual art show was a raised beadwork four-sided vase. It's really interesting because a lot of times my creations aren't designed with a specific purpose in mind, but it seems as the beadwork process continues and grows to being a completed item, there's a lot that can be read into my beadwork. And the specific vase, which is entitled Supporting Each Other and Creation, really speaks to the time when it was completed. And it was in March of this year, 2020. There was a solidarity movement around Turtle Island. There's been momentum in terms of solidarity movements within Turtle Island for a while now, but specifically this one that really impacted our community, or the community I live in right now, which is Ganawage. And there was basically a movement to support the people of the Wet'suwet'en in British Columbia and their efforts to stop industrial movements within their territory. And so what happened is here, as a movement and a sign of support, the people of Ganawage, the men blocked had put up a blockade by the train tracks, stopping the Canadian Railway from going through, or not necessarily stopping, but showing a force that, you know, maybe it's not a good idea. And so what happened is those people actually came to the community where I live. And at that time, I was finishing this vase, and I thought, you know what? This is what this is going to be. This vase is going to represent this time right now. And so what is very unique about my piece, and I've tried to implement it on a vase I did before, is I put people on my vase. And like Jamie Jacobs was referring to about the red color and how it is a longstanding color for everyone, because that is basically the blood that runs through our veins, everyone on earth. I made my people red, and on the vase, there's panels. There's four panels, and there's three women on two of the panels, and that represents the Wet'suwet'en women who were standing and blocking the industrial movement on their territory. And then there is the other two panels that have the two men and a woman, because everyone has to work together. It can't just be men or women. Communities have to work together in order to make movement, to stand, to defend themselves, and to help each other, to support each other. And then because a lot of my beadwork is floral, I thought that the band of floral raised beadwork could represent creation. And really, you have to have one. One does not live without the other. And well, creation can live by itself, but I mean, for humans, we obviously need creation. We need to be aware and be proactive in helping to maintain and preserve Mother Earth. And the blue beadwork on my vase is all line work, and traditionally, it's really done in white beadwork. Well, obviously, it really would have been done in quill work. That was the first art form there, and then it went to beadwork. So usually it's done with white beads. Now, for some reason, I chose blue. So it's kind of reflective of the blue waters that the Wet'suwet'en were trying to protect. So it there's a lot of meaning in the vase that didn't necessarily, wasn't there when I first started. When I put those beads on, I didn't think that's what it was. But as it progressed and as I completed it, that just was like in the forefront. That's what it spoke to me, and so that was my my piece that I submitted for the virtual Haudenosaunee Art Show.
And Leith, let me ask you about standing together, as you say, in some ways to stand against industrialization. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about that, because we have seen, probably with different pipeline projects, more than other projects I can remember in a long time, we've seen more non-Indigenous allies show up. We see people travel, to various places, Standing Rock, but others as well, to stand against violation of treaties and industrialization. Again, often for pipelines, but not always. Are you feeling that there is more awareness and interest in bringing in Indigenous voices in respecting lands and treaties? I mean, are you optimistic that that's the direction? I guess because from my perspective, there has to be allyship in order to find sort of progress in a direction of something that probably feels like equality. But are you an optimist in that regard, Leith?
I would agree that I believe there should be allyship. I think first and foremost, though, those who are being directly affected, and in this case it was the Wet'suwet'en, need to make a stand and then see how it happens. And it's really, you have to look at the situation and determine as an ally what it is you're going to do based on what the people, like the Indigenous people, are doing first. You know, like, you have to really make sure that you're working in tandem, and you can't be doing and trying to make movements that would maybe hinder or block some things from happening that Indigenous people are looking for in that regard. So I believe that allyship is very important. I believe that first and foremost, though, that recognition and respect and communication with Indigenous people needs to begin first. And then you bring in your allies to help and support, do whatever it is that is needed. Does that answer your question?
I think so, because honestly, until Standing Rock, there has not been probably a single movement or moment or issue that has brought more people, as many people out as those. There's more interest every year in Indigenous Peoples Day, and I know it's one day out of the year, but I think there's more, perhaps, as Peter Jemison was talking about earlier this hour, more forthright education about the history of Thanksgiving, not just sort of mythologizing. I think there's a lot of interesting things happening. And and I really appreciate the artist's perspective as well, because your art is beautiful and it does show a kind of harmony. But this has been a hard year. I mean, in your artist statement, you write, "This piece speaks to the various events of 2020 and how women and men must uphold their responsibilities to each and to protect creation." So my last question for you is, what are our responsibilities to each other as men and women, especially in light of what's happened in 2020?
Oh, I think I think right now at this very moment, everyone across the world is basically fighting the same fight, right? We're all trying to manage and make sure that we remain safe amongst this pandemic. And I think that's the first and foremost thing that needs to be done, is that literally you have to make sure that you are taking care of yourself, because you will potentially infect somebody else, or maybe worse, bring about a situation that could put somebody in the ground, right? Like, that's the situation, mm-hmm. is that we have to be aware of our own actions, where we go, what we do, who we come in contact with, what we put in the ground. You know, I come from a community who they can't drink the water, and so you have to buy bottled water. I have grandparents who both went to residential school, and I think that situation and those types of things need to be, one, looked at and to be acknowledged and to be taught, like you had said earlier about bringing in the education, and currently maybe the movement is maybe to hint to stop that from happening. But I think what really needs to begin is that we need to look at each other. Everyone is just as valuable as the next person. And I think standing together, that's not necessarily standing close, 6 feet apart, not holding hands, but standing together and being aware that we all affect each other is first and foremost for everyone's longevity on this earth. And I think that's the main takeaway. I think that 2020 really has shown that everyone is vulnerable. It doesn't matter if you're maybe a baron of these industrial companies, or if you're somebody who is working on the front lines at the local grocery store. Everyone is just as vulnerable as the next person. It's how we treat each other, though, that it's important. We need to treat everybody the same. We need to look at everybody the same way and say, you're just as valuable as the next person. And I'm going to myself make sure that I'm doing things right, because you are important.
Beautiful.
I think that's the main thing.
Yeah. Our last 2 minutes, Leith, your colleagues, the other artists on this program, have talked about some of the history, some of what they remember. Natasha talked about, you know, being 8 years old and thinking back to those memories. And Jamie talked about the importance of bringing art through generations. In our last 90 seconds or so, can you give me a sense for how you see your work and maybe a piece like this that I'm looking at, this beadwork, what it might mean to future generations?
I think what I hope that it reflects is that beadwork is intergenerational. Without what the previous artists have done in the past, we won't have what it is we are doing now, because a lot of the techniques are based on what techniques were done before. So I think that it's, in order to sustain the art form, you need to, as Jamie has done, look to the historians and look to the pieces, the artifacts and stuff that are there for that. And as Natasha said, you have to really engage other people. It can't be an art form that just stays in you and on your own hands. You have to be able to help and teach other people so that the longevity of all the art forms that we're talking about today is able to continue. And what better way to help promote and to also educate other people about the Haudenosaunee, but with the art form.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests. And Peter Jemison had to jump off the call just a few minutes ago to get going on another project that he's working on this afternoon. But, of course, we always appreciate the time and the wisdom from Peter Jemison, who is the historic site manager at Ganondagan. And let me thank the artist. Lee, thank you very much for the insight and the perspectives, and the beadwork is beautiful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jamie Jacobs, thank you very much for sharing your perspective. And once again, the artwork in this particular one we're looking at here is a Seneca handbag. It's beautiful. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me today.
Natasha Smoke Santiago, the sculptures we've been looking at, we appreciate that. And our listeners, you can find the work through Ganondagan's website. We'll also post on our various platforms. Thank you, Natasha. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you. Have a great day.
Wonderful conversation with all of the artists here. And we want to thank the whole team here at Connections this afternoon. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. And I'm Evan Dawson. And I have never been an artist, but I have a great appreciation for what we're seeing from our guests. And hope you'll check it out as well. And hope you have a beautiful afternoon. We will be back with you right here tomorrow, Wednesday, on Member Supported Public Radio.